Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
I've heard that electric cars are just as bad for the environment as regular cars. Is this true?
Do you have questions about the climate emergency? Well, The Climate Question is the podcast where you'll find the answers.
It's important for all of us trying to think about, understand, and affect change in the world.
The Climate Question from the BBC World Service. Listen now wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hello, I'm Charles Gitonga, and here's what's coming up for you on this edition of Focus on Africa. Why the relationship between South Africa and Taiwan is quite tense at the moment, and the wider one it shares with the rest of the continent.
Only one African country recognizes Taiwan, and that's Eswatini, which, as you know, is a very small country nestled between South Africa and Mozambique. There were others in the past, but systematically over the years, they've switched sides. Only one recognizes Taiwan. All the others recognize Beijing, you know, the People's Republic.
Also, the idea behind a new plan to plant 200 million mangrove trees in Mozambique. It's Monday, October 21st. First, we go to Soweto in South Africa. South Africa has recently been rocked by a series of food poisoning incidents. There have been a couple of serious cases recently. Just over a week ago, a sixth child from Soweto died in hospital after allegedly eating a snack from a store in the area. This incident sparked outrage across the community, with some local residents calling for the closure of these shops. The parents allege that the children, who were mostly under the age of 10, became ill after eating contaminated snacks. Police had to intervene to stop parents from burning down the stores, which have now been forced to close, and the owners have gone into hiding. This mother lost her son.
I called my son, Jabulo, come here, come tell me what happened. He said to me, my friends ate snacks. And I asked him, where did he buy the snacks? He said, around the passage. And I even repeatedly asked him, did you eat those snacks? He said, no. And then I think after 10 minutes from that time, Jabulo started to change. His face was starting to be purple. And then I took him off outside, actually. I used water, you know, just to wake him up. And he was not responding positively. So I started getting worried. So I asked one of the neighbors to call my two daughters to come and help me. So I had to change and immediately left to find transport to get help. They put a drip on him. They tried their best. They did their best. Unfortunately, our children couldn't fight the poison. When they confirmed the poison, they said they found a rat poison in our children's system.
A moving account there of one of the parents who has lost a child. There are growing calls for government to ensure the safety of food sold at these shops. Post-mortem examinations are being carried out to establish exactly what caused the children's deaths. You may remember earlier this month, there was another incident in Limpopo to the northeastern part of the country, following another incident of alleged food poisoning at a primary school when 35 pupils were taken to hospital after they started vomiting. And then again, another case in Gauteng when 50 school children fell ill after consuming food. Today, there are reports in South Africa that different state departments and agencies in the country say they are dealing with a chemical agent that could be behind these tragic events. Remember, these incidents are now under investigation. I've been speaking to Orin Singh, a local journalist at Eyewitness News. We spoke specifically about the recent incident in Soweto.
On the day, a group of children aged between 6 and 9 years old, who were all friends, had been playing in the community of Naledi as they would on any normal day. It's a very tight-knit community. All the families knew each other. They knew the children and the group. These children had been just playing around in the area. And the community and the parents, as far as they've been able to establish, alleged that the children had visited what we call as spaza shops, otherwise known as an informal trader. And the children had visited those shops during the course of the day. And the parents alleged that they had purchased chips from one of the two spaza shops situated on that road. And these chips are not branded chips. They come in a clear plastic packet. This specific type of chips is referred to as brown dash within the community. And these children had been seen eating those chips. And one of the children who actually subsequently died, one of these chips packets was found in his pocket. So shortly after consuming these chips, allegedly, the children had broken up and gone to their various homes. And they all complained of the same thing when they reached home, that they were very hungry. That's the one thing each of the family members told us. And so the parents started preparing food for them and giving them stuff to eat. And then not long after that, they started complaining of tummy cramps. They had pains within their stomach. They started sweating profusely. And then a number of them collapsed. They were frothing at the mouth and so forth. And this happened within a period of possibly an hour upon each of these children returning home. Most of the children were taken to a local clinic. One of the young boys who was 7 years old, he passed away in the vehicle, in his mom's arms, on the way to the clinic. Another young girl, Monica Sebotwane, she was 6 years old. She passed away at her home before her father could even get an ambulance. And so five of these children died on that Sunday within a matter of 2 to 3 hours. And that led to an uproar within the community. The community broke into those shops, basically shut them down, looted those shops, and police had to come in and get involved and stop the community from actually burning those shops down.
Talk to us just a bit more about these spaza shops. What are they? What's the setup like? And what do they sell?
In South Africa, there's a bit of mixed emotions when it comes to spaza shops because a lot, I wouldn't say majority, but a lot of the spaza shops are operated by foreign nationals. And over the years, they've developed quite a bad reputation of selling goods that seem to be expired, that are expired, not having goods that are up to quality in terms of the National Consumer Commission. And that's the body in South Africa that monitors goods that are sold to informal traders. But it's not all of the spaza shops operated within South Africa are operated by foreign nationals. There are South African owners who also operate spaza shops. But in any given spaza shop, you would find your everyday things. Some of them stock bread, milk, a lot of snacks, chips, biscuits. You'll be able to get toiletries, toilet paper. You'd be able to get dishwashing liquid, sanitary stuff, and so forth. They're convenient because they're situated within the community and within walking distance from these people's houses. Subsequently, after this incident, the National Consumer Commission, together with the Department of Health in Gauteng, Police and Home Affairs, have basically started to clamp down on spaza shops in Naledi. It's just unfortunate that an incident like this had to happen again after last year's tragedy for them to wake up and do something. But they've been doing a series of raids or inspections on spaza shops in Naledi and basically going to find out, number one, are the people who are renting these premises? And number two, the second thing they go and try and do is establish what products they have in the spaza shop, whether these products are expired, and where do these products come from? Because the biggest question is, who is supplying the products to the spaza shops? And the biggest issue that the National Consumer Commission have found is that these spaza shops don't keep a sales record. So it becomes very difficult for the authorities to ascertain as to who they've sold to and also where did they obtain the product from.
Let's talk about why then these shops are not regulated. Why is it the government is not able to find out the goods that they are selling, whether they are expired or not, where they come from?
I think it's an issue that's been going on for some time where we haven't seen health inspectors actually going out, not just to spaza shops, but just buildings that are generally bad within the city of Joburg. Proper inspections aren't carried out. And you know, having spoken to some people who work for the National Consumer Commission, they say they just don't have enough capacity. They don't have enough health inspectors. They don't have enough people that can go out on the ground and do this sort of work. And that boils down to national government at the end of the day, the Department of Health, and they needing to beef up their personnel within those specific departments to carry out these inspections, because these inspections are crucial.
So how is this case then of these children being handled?
Shortly after the kids passed away, we had a number of politicians visit the communities, as so they often do after an incident like this. And the Gauteng Premier, Phanyaza Lesufi, had said that he is giving a deadline of 2 weeks for the post-mortem results to be concluded and handed over to the parents. And those post-mortem results are crucial to ascertaining as to what actually killed these children. So right now, there's a lot of questions that are still up in the air. The families don't have any sort of closure, despite five of these children's families having buried them. Those questions will only be answered once we receive those post-mortem results, as well as the toxicology reports that will be done by police from a number of goods that they confiscated from these two spaza shops in question.
And what support then is being offered to the families that have been affected? And what can we expect from government in terms of assistance and justice to the victims?
I think the main justice for the victims that they all want, having spoken to all the families, is they want answers. They want to see justice served. We know that of the one spaza shop, the person who was renting it has since fled the community out of fear that he'd be killed. He's an Ethiopian national who goes by the name of Daniel. That's all we know about him. But we spoke to his partner, who's also gone into hiding with a child she shares with Daniel. And she says that they were living in the spaza shop. And if anything had to happen, it would have happened to her children first, because they were eating the chips from the spaza shop. They were living in there. So she doesn't believe that it was contamination from within the spaza shop.
All right. Aureen, thank you.
Thank you so much, Charles. Take care.
South African journalist Aureen Singh. A diplomatic row is now brewing between South Africa and Taiwan. That's after the South African government requested for Taiwan, the Asian nation, to relocate its representative office from Pretoria to Johannesburg. The South African government has set a deadline for the move by the end of October, allegedly under pressure from China. According to reports from Taiwan, the country's Ministry of Foreign Affairs is actively attempting to persuade South Africa to withdraw its demands. So what's going on? Before we find out, let me tell you a bit about the historic relationship between the two countries. Did you know that during the apartheid regime, South Africa recognized Taiwan and not China until South Africa's new democratically elected government in 1994? It was South Africa's then president, Nelson Mandela, who was quite keen to maintain formal relations with both China and Taiwan. But standing in his way was Beijing's One China policy. In this policy, China insists that there is only one Chinese government, and countries which hold formal ties with China cannot do the same with Taiwan, which China sees as a breakaway province to be unified with the mainland one day. This, therefore, meant South Africa's formal relationship with Taiwan wasn't possible, even though Taiwan is an independent country. So Taiwan has offices which act as a formal embassy in South Africa. I've been speaking to foreign affairs journalist for the Daily Maverick in South Africa, Peter Fabricius, and asked him if this decision by South Africa to move Taiwan's office was a downgrade.
No, it would be a downgrade. I mean, Taiwan likes to maintain its position as, I suppose, if you like, a kind of unique entity. To be downgraded from its current liaison office, which is a kind of a sort of embassy, to a trade office, I think is humiliating in a way for them.
So is there anything that having a liaison office in Pretoria would give you that Johannesburg wouldn't?
It's obviously more symbolic than anything else. I mean, Pretoria is the capital. It's where all the other embassies are. It's where all the other diplomats are based. And, you know, Taiwan does like to associate itself with those other embassies, which give it, if you like, a kind of de facto recognition. As you know, Taiwan is not widely recognized officially by anyone in the world, but it is, for practical purposes, recognized by Western countries in particular. And so it associates with them. It has contacts in Pretoria, which it wouldn't have in Johannesburg. But it's a symbolic difference, I think, more than anything else.
So why is South Africa then doing this?
You know, this is the question. I mean, South Africa tends to do what China wants it to do. And that's the criticism that's been leveled at the South African government. They're part of BRICS, so they have a relationship with China through BRICS. They also have quite a big trade relationship with China, which is now South Africa's single largest national trading partner. And it's not just the trade relationship with China. And in fact, it's more the political relationship with China that is behind this. But it's really to do with BRICS and China's attempt to become a kind of leader of the non-Western part of the world, you know, which I think is behind this.
How is Taiwan likely to react to this?
Taiwan hasn't officially issued a statement, although I was told that it was going to do so. But according to Taiwanese media, it is contemplating how it should retaliate. And for example, the issues that have been mentioned are tightening up on the issue of visas to South Africans. And in particular, there's quite a few, supposedly around about 5,000. Generally, it's young South Africans who teach English in Taiwan. And so there's been some sort of suggestion that might be cut down or restricted or terminated. And the other thing is that there's apparently, according to these reports, what Taiwan might do is retaliate directly by demanding that South Africa move its office out of Taipei into what's called New Taipei, which is a kind of a nearby but separate city.
Let's then talk about Taiwan's relationship with the continent, because in an article that you wrote a few years ago, you said Taiwan has now become an almost forgotten casualty of China's big drive into Africa over the past two decades. Tell us more.
The measure of that really is that only one African country now recognizes Taiwan, and that's Eswatini, which, as you know, is a very small country. There were others in the past, but systematically over the years, they've switched sides. And I mean, a lot of it is to do with, I believe, and this certainly is the Taiwanese belief, that a lot of it has to do with material inducements, aid, you know, whatever, investment, trade, etc. And of course, it's quite difficult to be the odd man out. So, you know, the pressure of conformity has been very strong as well on African countries. So that's where we stand. There are a few other countries in the world, but also small, and some islands in the Pacific and so on.
But how was that relationship then with these African countries, especially before China became this big economic and political force in Africa?
Yeah, look, I mean, I think that they had normal relationships with Taiwan. It's not just a one-way street when it comes to, if you like, buying influence. I mean, Taiwan also has done its best to invest in countries, you know, to provide them with aid, as it still does in South Africa, by the way, not in gigantic, you know, quantities, but it does. Taiwan conducted its relationship with African countries pretty much along the conventional lines, you know, quite a lot of aid, as most, you know, developed countries focus on in their relationship with African countries.
What then can Taiwan do to navigate this?
Yeah, look, I don't think there's a huge amount it can do, to be honest. I mean, what it tried to do was to step up its own aid and so on with these countries to compete with China. And there was a period, you know, I think before Xi Jinping became president, because I think he changed the stance of China globally in many ways, including this. There was a period when there was a kind of an unwritten agreement between China and Taiwan that they would not compete with each other and try to, you know, steal, if you like, countries from each other. And then I think Xi Jinping, though, has made the recovery of Taiwan a major part of his foreign policy platform. And many would think maybe also getting Taiwan back into China as his major legacy as a leader.
I wonder if you could tell us what kind of relationship then Taiwan has with Eswatini, the only country on the continent that recognizes it, and how that relationship is useful to both of these parties.
It's useful to Taiwan to a degree because it's a kind of last foothold that it has on the continent. Taiwan regards the recognition as an important survival instrument, actually. And from Eswatini's point of view, I mean, Eswatini is quite a conservative country, right? So you have a kind of an absolute monarchy, not very attuned to, you know, the political thinking of a lot of other African countries. And it gets quite a lot of aid, you know, from Taiwan. It gets some investment. It has Taiwanese, like, textile factories and so on in Eswatini, which are to some degree linked to recognition. So, yeah. It comes with some benefits. And I guess you could say in some ways some costs, but that's the choice they made.
Does that cost include, you know, the relationship with China that's for Eswatini?
Yeah, because, I mean, as we know, China does not tolerate dual recognition. It doesn't allow anyone to pursue a two-China policy. So if you recognize Taiwan, then you by definition don't recognize Beijing. So it doesn't get invited to the FOCAC, for example, a Forum for China-Africa Cooperation, which is quite a big deal, and also comes with quite a lot of, you know, money, material benefits for those African countries that are part of China's stable. But somewhere down the line, who knows, maybe they will switch as well.
I wonder if we can flip the coin and look at whether African countries should be rethinking their relationship with Taiwan and not really place all their allegiances to China.
You're suggesting that they should adopt a more balanced approach. But as I said, China doesn't really tolerate a balanced approach. That would be the logical thing, actually, from Africa's perspective, is to have relationships with both, you know, if it was possible, which is what Mandela was attempting 26 years ago. If you could have good relations with Taiwan and good relations with Beijing, you'd be in a good place. My own view is that they shouldn't allow themselves to be bullied in a way. You know, I mean, Taiwan wouldn't mind very much if countries recognized, you know, both Taiwan and China. They wouldn't mind it at all. They don't deny the existence of China. They fully recognize China themselves. It obviously comes with full UN blessing and so on that, you know, the UN only recognizes China. Even the US since 71 or 2 only recognizes China. But it doesn't justify the kind of thing that we're seeing now in the case of South Africa. So, I mean, the kind of relationship that South Africa's got with Taiwan and Beijing is something which other, you know, African countries could also emulate, and some do. But, you know, a few years ago, Nigeria had a similar issue. China objected to Taiwan having an office in the capital, Abuja. And so Nigeria compelled Taiwan to move its office out of Abuja to Lagos, in the same way that we believe that China is trying to force South Africa to compel Taiwan to move its office from Pretoria to Johannesburg. I guess for African countries, the idea would be to try as hard as possible to maintain the best relationship that they can with Taiwan in these circumstances.
South African journalist Peter Fabricius. This is Focus on Africa from the BBC World Service.
I've heard that electric cars are just as bad for the environment as regular cars. Is this true?
Do you have questions about the climate emergency? Well, The Climate Question is the podcast where you'll find the answers.
It's important for all of us trying to think about, understand, and affect change in the world.
The Climate Question from the BBC World Service. Listen now wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
To Mozambique now. The country is on the front line of the climate crisis, with intense tropical storms hitting on a regular basis. The destruction caused by these storms is made worse by deforestation because of logging. But now, a Gulf-based company, Blue Forest, says it has secured a contract to plant 200 million mangrove trees along Mozambique's vast coastline. For the Mozambique government, this will be the start of a much-needed regeneration. I spoke to reporter Jose Tembe to learn more about this initiative. Start by telling us the ways in which Mozambique has been affected by climate change.
Climate change caused here by, among other things, deforestation, pollution, and poor waste management has led to critical natural disasters, including drought, flooding, and cyclones. And these have been very deadly and destructive to public and private property.
And why are mangroves then so important to the ecosystem of the country?
Well, mangroves are very important for, among other things, coastal protection against erosion and violent storm surges. In addition, mangroves are highly crucial to sequestrate carbon dioxide and improve water quality by filtering water pollutants. Furthermore, they provide critical habitats for species like fish, shrimps, crabs, and birds.
So how is the loss of that ecosystem then impacting the ecology of Mozambique and the people that live there? You had mentioned about destruction of property, livelihoods. You could expound on that for us.
Well, the devastation of mangroves in Mozambique have had significant negative impact on the country's ecology. For instance, the destructive and deadly natural disasters coupled with erosion and poor living conditions of species. Mozambican ecologist Carla Mauman says that projects like this, replanting of mangroves, are essential not only to protect the coastline, but also the livelihoods of the people who live there.
Having a protected, well-maintained mangrove ecosystem means we'll have a rich diversity of trees and plants, as well as marine and river-dwelling creatures. This will benefit us economically, socially, and environmentally. We'll be healthier because the mangrove trees will absorb carbon dioxide and transform it into oxygen, which will give us a purer environment. At the same time, the mangroves will act as a nursery for both marine and bird species. There'll also be a wider variety of fish. This will boost our economy because fishermen will have lots to sell and they'll have more money to buy what they need and pay for services.
Tell me then about this Gulf-based company called Blue Forest and why they would be interested in a project that seeks to restore mangroves in Mozambique.
Well, Blue Forest is a Gulf-based global developer of large-scale mangrove restoration projects. So this is a specialized company on mangroves, especially in their restoration. So I spoke to the company's founder and the chief executive officer, Vaid Fotouli, who had this to say.
The core objective is to first restore the degraded areas that exist along that coastline and which add up to about 30,000 hectares of degraded mangroves. And secondly, to conserve the standing mangroves that are there, which span across about 120,000 hectares. We understand it's very important to engage with the communities and have them feel a sense of ownership of the project, because if you don't do that, the degradation will continue.
That's Vaid Fotouli, who is the CEO of Blue Forest. Jose, were there other local companies that could have taken up this project, or even companies from African countries that could have done it?
This was such one of 40 bids, and according to the government, there's still plenty of other companies interested and under evaluation or on feasibility study. These are national and international, including African companies, that if also approved, they may also contribute to help restore mangroves and improve Mozambique's economic, human, and other social aspects.
So help us then understand a bit more about that project. Is it a long-term project? How long will it take, and how many more companies might get involved in the process?
This project is very important, as I explained. 30,000 hectares of degraded mangroves will be replanted, and the company Blue Forest will conserve about 120,000 hectares of standing mangroves. So in addition to restoring, it will also raise awareness in people to avoid cutting mangroves and to replant wherever mangroves are destroyed.
So in terms of the community then, involving the community, in what ways are mangroves used by the communities?
Communities have used the mangroves in construction mainly. That's why they destroy them. But also they destroy them when they search for fisheries products in the seas. You know, Mozambique has a long, vast coastal area of about 2,500 kilometers. Along these places, you have many different communities who use the sea for fishing. And when they destroy the mangroves, the species in the sea can hardly reproduce. produce, the destructed mangroves also have a bad impact, not only on the fisheries, but on the communities themselves, because it will be easy for the land to be eroded. So erosion will expand and they eat more and more of land, which they need for other purposes.
Do the communities that live along this coastline feel or see the impacts of what they do, that if you cut more trees, then this is going to happen? Do you think there's that sort of basic understanding among them?
Yeah, well, there are many who actually do not understand. That's why there is a need of raising awareness for people to understand the importance of mangroves, not only for construction as they use them, but also to improve the livelihoods of species and also to avoid erosion, which will have bad consequences for them. If the seawaters can enter their areas, they will destroy buildings or other infrastructure. So this must be understood for them to ensure that whenever they cut resources for construction, they have to replant.
Thank you very much for your time, Jose.
Oh, you're welcome, Charles.
Jose Tembe there, BBC journalist based in Mozambique. Focus on Africa was put together by Patricia Whitehorn, Stefania Okereke, Amy Leibovitz, Audrey Brown and Nyasha Michelle in London. Connie Sharp was the senior journalist in charge and Nick Randell was the technical producer. Our editors are Andre Lombard and Alice Mudengi. I'm Charles Gitonga. Goodbye for now.
I've heard that electric cars are just as bad for the environment as regular cars. Is this true?
Do you have questions about the climate emergency? Well, The Climate Question is the podcast where you'll find the answers.
It's important for all of us trying to think about, understand, and affect change in the world.
The Climate Question from the BBC World Service. Listen now wherever you get your BBC podcasts.